This is Susan Rude Wilson on November 14th, 2014. Experiencing the Numinous in Everyday Life, The Daily Quest for a Life of Meaning. And the title of the talk is The Comet, A Wild Ride on the Fiery Tail. This talk included a slideshow, and the images in the slideshow are available on the DVD in the library of the Seattle Jung Society.
It is my great pleasure to welcome Susan Wilson tonight. She's going to be our storyteller and talk about numinosity in everyday life. So it isn't something that just happens only to Paul on his way to Damascus when he gets knocked off his horse and has a numinous experience. Susan's going to say that we all have them every day, and this is very, very important for everybody to realize. Susan is a Jungian analyst in the C.G. Jung Institute of Seattle. She trained at NIPIAP, which is our former title, here in Seattle. She grew up in Southern California, has been a psychotherapist for 34 years, and an analyst for six. So please welcome Susan Wilson.
Good evening. Thank you to the Jung Society also for being so kind and agreeing to work with the C.G. Jung Institute, since we are sister organizations, and I really am very pleased to be able to present tonight. So, I have a long story to tell, and I want you to hear it, so I will take maybe a little bit of a shorter break than usual, and I will leave time for questions, I promise. So, now, close your eyes. Listen to Jung's words from the Red Book. The years of which I have spoken to you, when I pursued the inner images, were the most important time of my life. Everything else is to be derived from this. It began at that time, and the later details hardly matter anymore. My entire life consisted in elaborating what had burst forth from the unconscious and flooded me like an enigmatic stream and threatened to break me. That was the stuff and material for more than only one life. Everything later was merely the outer classification, the scientific elaboration, and the integration into life. But the numinous beginning, which contained everything, was then. For Jung, his experiences contained everything. Yet I find in the Jungian world of lectures and books that this crucial emphasis on numinous experience as a source is vanishing. Jung borrowed the term numinous from Rudolf Otto's book, The Idea of the Holy, published in 1917. Otto used the word to mean the tremendous, mysterious, and fascinating manner in which a synchronicity or a dream breaks into consciousness in a meaningful way. You know the feeling, that chilling moment when you realize you are in the presence of something greater than you, something at work upon you. A powerful dream, a synchronicity, a feeling of, that something overwhelms you, makes you gasp, or cry in pain, or know that you are but a cog in a great wheel larger than your own life. It can be dark or painful, just as easily as joyous. The word numinous comes from Latin, numen, meaning the knot of God's head. Can you imagine how large that would be? It seems the numinous is being relegated to a theory about the numinous. Numinous experiences are not theoretical, but personal, often overwhelmingly so, as Jung said of his own encounter with the numinous during his writing of the Red Book. Rather than attending to the numinous itself, which seems to dominate our profession and our lectures, our theories of the numinous, explanations of it as if it were necessary to shield ourselves from the raw jolt that comes with the nod of God's head. One attempt to explain the numinous is a book entitled The Idea of the Numinous, kind of awkward, a takeoff from Rudolf Otto's book, The Idea of the Holy. There are contributions written by several famous Jungians, Freudians, and others from the postmodern and philosophical realms. I was disappointed in this book. Almost none of the authors of the essays delve into the experience of the numinous, neither their own experiences nor those of their patients. Instead, the contributors to the book focus on ways to explain the appearance of the numinous, and this perplexes and upsets me. There are two reasons for my confusion and upset. First, my experiences of the numinous have been relentless since my childhood, reminding me that psyche's goals are often in direct opposition to the daily demands of my conscious goals or of my domestic life. The second reason is the dismissal or disappearance of the importance of numinous experience per se in current Jungian psychological practice, and even in the individuation processes of analysts and therapists themselves. Jung made it very clear that individuants, people who are on a path towards individuation, need to take seriously the immediate images emerging from the unconscious. He warned that it is not enough to understand the images of the unconscious and to marvel at them and think we are then finished and done with our work. Listen to what Jung says in his autobiography. I took great care to understand every single image, every item of my psychic inventory, and to classify them scientifically, so far as this was possible, and above all, to realize them in actual life. That is what we usually neglect to do. We allow the images to rise up, and maybe we wonder about them, but that is all. We do not take the trouble to understand them, let alone draw ethical conclusions from them. It is equally a grave mistake to think that it is enough to gain some understanding of the images and that knowledge can here make a halt. Insight into them must be converted into an ethical obligation. I have always taken Jung's words as a prescription. In our personal therapy or analysis, we are asked to produce dreams, to write them down, to be assiduous in our efforts. We make an attempt to understand the dream in context to our complexes, and we often stop right there. But there is more. As Jung states, this is just the beginning. The images of the unconscious place a great responsibility upon us, not simply to gain an intellectual, psychological, or theoretical understanding of them. It is not enough to connect them up to our own personal complexes and then consider ourselves well analyzed and finished. No, according to Jung, we owe an ethical obligation to the images of the unconscious. What does that mean, obligated ethically? It means to do something with these numinous images. Do what? Draw them? Yes. Write them? Yes. What else? I think there is more. In tomorrow's workshop, we will do more with these numinous images in a way that moves them forward into the world and has the potential to give greater meaning to our lives. So now to introduce my work, I wish to say first that my conscious life always came from a knowledge I had of myself from my earliest memories, dreams, and other events from the time I was a small child. If you are coming to tomorrow's workshop, whatever dreams or synchronicities or numinous experiences you bring with you to work on will likely not be unfamiliar to you in this regard. The psyche tends to gather to it what it is already, and numinous experiences often manifest as a way to punctuate who we have always been and to expand on what we are to become always in relation to those first moments when we became aware of something greater. We will work with these experiences to show you how everything that occurs, the numinous things that occur, have an elision. They're elided. And back to those very first experiences, such as single or repetitive dreams or impacting events. Everything that emerges from these early times will stay with you, and things will continue to manifest as they did when you were your original self. The story I'm going to tell you tonight came from a dream that emerged about a dozen or so years ago. As I've worked with the dream, I realized that the images in the dream tied me back to my original self. This dream has directed me down many avenues that have presented themselves in non-linear or chronological ways. The unfurling of the dream has not required an effort in the sense that we think of an effort. It has taken consciousness and energy directed towards it. These events, which I will describe, did not happen every day or even every month. I do not feel that the dream and the events that have ensued from the dream will ever end in the sense that the mystery will ever be fully solved. When one works with a dream or numinous experience over the course of time, the dream grows, life changes, and more numinous things occur. There is always more interesting work to be done. It becomes a life's work. Sometimes there were gaps as I worked on the dream. Daily life got the best of me and took me away from the journey. Not all of us have the luxury of time and freedom, as Jung did when he was writing all of his work, including the Red Book. Most of us deal with matters of earning a living, raising kids, mowing our lawns, going to Home Depot to fix our own faucets, unlike Jung, things that are necessary and just plain trying to maintain. But there's also the necessity of paying attention to the demands of the psyche, despite the things that yank at us. When we do not pay attention to these amazing unconscious productions, the noumen, the knot of God's head, goes unnoticed. We fail to watch, fail to connect the dots, and fail to take action. Then things can begin to feel somewhat meaningless and empty. Believing that what comes from the unconscious is more important to our well-being than the daily things we do to make do. Maybe you have a dream on a Friday night, and the dream is about walking in the rain. When you check the weather forecast, it says, rain Saturday and clearing on Sunday. Would you forego the business you had to attend to on Saturday, which you could just as easily do on Sunday, in order to pay close attention to the dream? If you honored the dream, what would you attend to on that rainy walk on Saturday, if you took it? What would you be watching for, open to? You just got a psychic prescription. What impact would taking the medicine bring? Why would you put this prescription above your daily usages? I would say that not to do so is to fail to create a life of meaning, to fail at the ethical obligation to the unconscious. Strong words, I know. I came into this world as my original self, as an inquisitive human being. I have followed the hints in my dreams from the first dreams I can recall, the synchronicities, niggling inklings, and the puncturings from the external world into my inner life and the other way around. Charles Kuralt, the veteran CBS news reporter who passed away in the 90s, was someone I admired very much. He said in his retirement interview in a 60-minute special broadcast, "It always works out fine if you just keep your eyes open and force yourself to go slow, stay off the interstate, stick to the back roads, and never lose an opportunity to shoot the breeze with someone on the corner." To my way of thinking, Kuralt was describing the perfect situation in which a numinous experience might occur. Observing, going slowly, taking chances, and leaving an opening for anything that might arrive. Much of my present endeavors have derived from working with a particular dream, which have led me to many other numinous experiences and wild discoveries. I had no idea that this dream would become a life's project. I do not know where it may lead, but that's not the point. The idea is to keep moving towards the energy charge the numinous generates and to keep moving towards more life. So I'll now tell you the dream. Sometime well over a dozen years ago, I was seeing Russell Lockhart for analysis. Russ was one of our first analysts in the Northwest and he still resides here. He continues to write and work, and also continues to be a most important influence in my life and my work. Now look at this image coming up here. This is a completely photoshopped image. On the registration table, there are some postcards for Dreamwell Studios. And this building does not exist whatsoever. This was an image that was created by me and this woman, Ann Maxwell, out of my own dream image. And it's about as close as it can possibly get. It's really quite astounding to think that your image can be made in a photograph. So all of this, this building is in Olympia, right, Henry? This does not exist. The lawn does not exist. It's all created. So I just wanted you to kind of get a sense. Please pick up a postcard. The dream. I am with Russ. We are standing on the steps of a building which is on a large green lawn. This is a Victorian or Edwardian era gray stone building. The building seems to be important, perhaps a city administrative building or a library. It has a large archway with a keystone. The area has a feel of a town here in the Pacific Northwest, Port Angeles, and it is late afternoon. The building is in the shadow of a bluff, perhaps in the foothills of the Olympics, and there are some tall trees just touched by the afternoon sun, but it definitely has the feel of Port Angeles. Russ then says to me, "Go get a book on the Oddfellows." At that time, I had absolutely no idea who the Oddfellows were. All I knew was that they were one of those old-timey fraternal orders. As a young girl growing up in Los Angeles, my family would often go to my Aunt Bessie and Uncle Filippo's house in North Hollywood. My brother and I knew we were getting close to their house when we would pass a building with three concatenated rings, you know, the linked rings, over the lintel of the door. We didn't know it at the time, but that was the Oddfellows Lodge in North Hollywood. And those concatenated rings symbolize friendship, love, and truth. There you are. I had no idea at the time that the Independent Order of Oddfellows, the IOOF, would ever hold any significance for me. But to ethically honor my dream with Russ, where he told me to go get a book on the Oddfellows, I went ahead and did some research into the fraternal order and found they were similar to the Masons and even shared a good deal of their symbolism. But they were two different fraternal groups. I had no idea at the time what to do with the dream, but it felt important and I kept it with me. To keep a dream with you is a different thing from just understanding a dream. It means having the dream with you as you go through your day, or as I have done for many years now. It means what Jung discussed in the paragraph I just read about an ethical obligation. The dream felt particularly important because here was Russ telling me to get a book on the Oddfellows. I know when I have a dream where I'm being spoken to, it is bound to be important. So off and on, I wondered about the dream. I looked into the Oddfellows organization, learned that they may have been ungilded workmen, perhaps even the hod or mortar carriers for the Masons. Lest any of you are thinking the same thing, perhaps my dream, Russ, was simply telling me that I'm an odd fellow, which isn't too far off from the mark, but there's some truth to that. That the etymology of the word is noteworthy. Looking at the archetypal roots of words can often shed light on deeper meaning. What stood out most in the etymology of the word odd is that it's like a point of land related to a triangle and also the point of a weapon. So a thing that sticks out between two other things is the odd thing. So the two would be even, and then the third, the odd, or the transcendent, you could think of it, would stick out. Around the same time I had the Oddfellows dream, my friend and colleague Lillian Palermo came to visit me from Lummi Island. She had done an act of imagination in which a black Madonna appeared in blue robes standing on an egg with stars all around her head. Now, in this image, this is the Black Madonna of Chartres, which we visited last summer. And you can see these stars that are in, or surround her, and also down here. And I'll get back to that in a bit. At that time, neither of us was all that, this is Lillian and I now, we're all that familiar with the Black Madonna. But we decided to go on a quest in Seattle to find one. not happening. An adventure, I thought. My son Henry, who's right here, who was 3 years old at the time, was in the back of his car seat. It is my joy that Henry has shared so many of my Odd Fellows adventures. Looks a little different today. To pursue Lillian's Black Madonna image, I thought we would go to an area of town where a darker-skinned or brown virgin, such as the Lady of Guadalupe, would be displayed. I already knew of an area south of downtown Seattle called Georgetown, where there's a Guadalupan church. Georgetown is a colorful area, peppered with bars and jazz clubs and breweries, as well as most of the brothels in Seattle at the turn of the last century. It's come to play a significant role in my life, but not for those reasons. So. Once we got to Georgetown, we began to look for St. George's Catholic Church. We got lost and needed directions. There was only one person on the street from whom to ask directions. She was an older woman in a blue dress and hat. Lillian leaned out the window and asked her if she knew where St. George's Church was. The woman approached the car, and as she did, she leaned forward towards us, and a huge crucifix fell forward from her neck. She was a nun. Sister Zosma was her name. She said, "I live in the convent at St. George's, and if you take me up there, I'll show you the church." We were flabbergasted by this synchronicity. We just, you know, we readily agreed to take her up Beacon Hill to the church. On the way, she told us she was Franciscan, which I knew to be a teaching order. And I asked her what she taught, and she replied, "Iconography. I teach icon painting." I just gasped again. So the basement of the convent was filled with all kinds of Catholic icons and many books on the Black Madonna. She told us the Catholic Church does not recognize the Black Madonna because of its roots in pagan tradition, and there would be no Black Madonnas in any Catholic church. Little did we know. It worked out for us. So, you know, the five-pointed star, I've come back to again in a bit, but I just wanted you to have a look at those stars, okay? Georgetown has since become the center of so many numinous experiences for me. I don't know why that is, and perhaps one day it might be revealed. Maybe not. A friend of mine, Faith, who's here tonight, was an English teacher at Cleveland High School on Beacon Hill above Georgetown. She once told me that years ago, her honors English class, was approached by the Washington State Cemetery Association to write a book on a cemetery near St. George's Church and near the high school on Beacon Hill. The cemetery is called the Comet Lodge Cemetery. I didn't think anything at the time. She once showed me the book, but it was not something I really had time to read back then. One year from my birthday, Henry found a book on Odd Fellow symbolism, and these books are here, incidentally, to look at, in a bookshop in Port Townsend. I reckoned the dream was finally being honored. I still did not understand why Russ had told me in the dream to get a book on the Odd Fellows, but thanks to Henry, I had a book now. I still had a persistent, nagging feeling I get when I know that that there was more I needed to know, but for the moment, I simply had run into a dead end. For a while, I forgot about it. Then another numinous event occurred. I heard from a friend about a museum in Seattle, the Museum of Mysteries. It sounded unusual and interesting and had a library that archived the most haunted places in Seattle. I took Henry and his nanny, Anne Marie. Another adventure. From that tour, I learned more about the Comet Lodge Cemetery on Beacon Hill that Faith's class had written the book about. I learned it was one of the most haunted places in Seattle. There's a story behind that I won't go into. Now, I became very interested in Faith's book and asked her for a copy, which is here. Why it was called Comet intrigued me. I wondered, as most people probably do, if it had something to do with Halley's Comet, which came around in 1835 and again in 1910. When I mentioned this to Faith, she said she thought the information was probably in the first pages of the book. Here's what she read to me. Aside from the life insurance handlers, Seattle's own Beacon Hill had its share of cemetery inaugurators. The Comet Lodge Council, a group affiliated with the fraternal organization known as the Independent Order of Odd Fellows. And I just gasped. I was toast. Also included in the book was a photocopy of the original Articles of Incorporation from December 1893, which was almost 13 years shy of the reappearance of Halley's Comet. For the IOOF Lodge, this is the Articles of Incorporation for the Odd Fellows Lodge, number 139, Duwamish, now Georgetown, Washington. The founders of the lodge were listed by their first and middle initials and then their full last names. Now I knew I needed to pursue the comet, the inurnus, the answer about the Comet Lodge, number 139, Georgetown. I was back on the hunt. What has ensued has been a numinous journey on the back roads, on and off the information highway, and in conversations with many people along the way. The very next thing I did was to look in the Odd Fellows symbol book Henry had given me for my birthday. Many of the Odd Fellows symbols are exactly the same as Masonic symbols. However, in the Odd Fellows book, I could find no comet. I kept thinking of the organizations were related in some way, maybe that the Odd Fellows had taken the Masonic symbols, but I assumed they were not related in any other way. In the Masons, there are several references to comets, including in the third degree initiation ritual. In reference to the all-seeing eye, I have a pin, it was a Halley's Comet pin. Okay, in reference to the all-seeing eye in the liturgy for the third degree, the Master Mason degree, the Grand Master says, "The sword pointing to a naked heart demonstrates that justice will sooner or later overtake us. And although our thoughts, words, and actions may be hidden from the eyes of man, yet the all-seeing eye, whom the sun, moon, and stars obey, and under whose watchful care even comets perform their stupendous revolutions, pervades the whole and will reward us according to our merits." This passage is not from an Odd Fellows ritual. It is Masonic. Discouraged about the lack of information on comets in the Odd Fellows tradition and why an Odd Fellows lodge would be called Comet, I began researching comets in the Masons. The fraternal order movement as a whole is declining in this century. But at the turn of the last century, fraternal orders were flourishing. I found several comet lodges on internet searches. Some were Odd Fellows lodges and several were Masons. I made call to these lodges that were still in existence or across the country. I called the Odd Fellows Comet Lodge in Nottoway County, Missouri, number 289. I told them I wanted to know where the name of the lodge came from. I made up some story about my grandmother. I said had been a Rebecca, the women's auxiliary of the Odd Fellows, and he wanted to know where the name came from. You know, it's driving me to this stuff. No one had any information, at least anyone would share it with me. When I called the Masonic Comet Lodge at number 229 in Cerisco, Nebraska, they only referred to the all-seeing eye passage I quoted above. Maybe they really didn't know or any more than that, or maybe this they were just not going to say. I was getting nowhere. For a while, I felt depressed. I felt angry. Everywhere I looked, I saw Masonic symbols and logos, advertisements, everywhere. I felt as if there was a conspiracy of silence operating underground about which I and most of the world were unaware and could not ever discover. Then I had a conversation with an analyst in our institute, Terry Gibson. Terry lives in a Masonic lodge near Tacoma. He told me to get hold of John Michael Greer, who is a widely published author, an Odd Fellow, a Mason, and a member of the Ancient Order of Druids. Wow. Who was living in the Northwest. I was able to find him on the internet. I was able to start an email correspondence with him about the comet and why the Odd Fellows might have chosen the name. After a volley of emails, he told me out of the blue that he was moving to Baltimore. That's the last I heard from him. This is one of many conversations I had with Masons and Odd Fellows about comets that began and ended abruptly. At first, as an extrovert, I was excited and animated when I spoke to Masons and Odd Fellows. Eventually, I learned that this was a giant red flag for secret orders. I learned that to get any information from Masons or Odd Fellows, I could not be direct or act excited, although I was. They have secrets, and they mean it. I started to become more circumspect in my approach. Henry and I started exploring all the quirky shops in Georgetown. In the Georgetown record shop, I asked the owner if he knew of anyone who could tell me something about the Comet Lodge 139. And he told me about a woman named Liddell, who owned a grocery store that was once a roadhouse, a brothel, a speakeasy during Prohibition. We went to her shop, the Carlton Market, which is still in Georgetown, of course. Liddell and I have become good friends. We have assisted one another in our mutual interests about Georgetown history. Together, we went to many historical collections and archives. The research that helped me the most were the phone books from the time the Comet Lodge formed. It was there I was able to find the first and middle names of the men who were designated officers on the Articles of Incorporation. From this information, I was able to learn that C.S. Maple was Charles Sumner Maple, and A.B. Maple was Alvin Bishop Maple, and they helped to form the Comet Lodge. Sometime before this, the official Georgetown historian, Pat Filer, recommended that I contact Louise Jones Brown, a descendant of the Maple family, who was doing research about her own ancestors. After discovering the connection between the Maples and the Comet Lodge, I decided to get hold of Louise. It turns out Louise is a kindred soul, as dogged as I am, and together we brainstormed about how to find information about the Comet Lodge and her ancestors. Louise told me that Charles and Alvin's father, Jacob Maple, and their eldest brother, Samuel, had gone to California during the Gold Rush. Louise and I wondered if they belonged to the Odd Fellows Comet Lodge number 84 in near Mount Shasta, where they were panning for gold in 1848. This lodge is no longer active, though the building still stands here. We needed to find out if Jacob and Samuel Maple were members of that Shasta Comet Lodge. I made a phone call to the Odd Fellows Grand Lodge of California near San Francisco. I learned from the Grand Secretary that the Comet Lodge near Shasta was not incorporated until 1859. Jacob and Samuel were already in Washington by June of 1851. He told me that to start an Odd Fellows Lodge, there would need to be 5 third-degree initiates. This would mean that Charles and Alvin were initiated at another Odd Fellows Lodge, maybe in Seattle, maybe back in Iowa or Ohio, where the family had lived prior to coming to Seattle. I never heard from this nice Odd Fellows man again either. Louise and I were now sisters in this quest, and we were on a roll. She told me that Beacon Hill was once called Maple Hill, named for her ancestors. Jacob and Samuel were once buried at the Comet Lodge Cemetery, but later their remains were moved to a gravesite in front of the Boeing Administration Building, which is where they reside now. Isn't that nice? Boeing. I started focusing on the Masons because I realized I was receiving no assistance from anyone in Odd Fellows groups. Things began to escalate. I wondered early in my investigation if the men who founded the Comet Lodge in Georgetown were also Masons. Louise told me that Charles Sumner Maple's son, Charles Stanley Maple, had in fact died in the Masonic home here in Des Moines, just south of Seattle. Of course, Henry and I had to go there too. It's cool. Look at that building. Isn't that great? It is in the end. Yeah, it's right in Des Moines. It is stated in many of the source books I have read that fathers would often bring their sons into their same fraternal orders. The father-to-son rite of passage was really never discussed openly, maybe because it was an expected practice, or again, because it was a secret ritual. I wondered, therefore, if Jung may have been a Mason. After all, his grandfather was an ardent Freemason and Grand Master of the Swiss Lodge, which he mentions in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. At first, I dismissed the thought as absurd, since it appears throughout the collected works that Jung was no fan of the Masons, and nor of joining clubs at all. Nonetheless, I learned through my research that one indicator of a successful businessman at the turn of the last century was how many fraternal groups to which he belonged. It would not have been unusual for the Maples to have been Masons also. I wondered if all the men who started the Comet Lodge were also Masons. I dismissed this thought as well, since I felt they were still two separate groups. There was no direct evidence one way or another. Later on, I was teaching a seminar on alchemy at our Seattle Jung Institute. It is often strange to me how the mind works or doesn't work. You can know something, but make no leap to a related topic, as though the synapses remain in like a fixed pattern in your head until something occurs that jars the separate synapsing patterns into a whole. In my experience, that jarring can often be a synchronicity or some other numinous experience that joins things from separation to a knowledge of the whole. It was from my seminar on alchemy that I came to the realization that Masonic symbols and alchemical symbols were often the same. If I had thought about these things earlier, I may have realized at the time I was learning about Masons and Oddfellows that they were all part of a whole as well, but I just didn't make the connection at the time. In going through the literature, both Masonic and alchemical, the symbol of the comet appears over and over. I knew this already, having been exposed to so many of the alchemical symbols and separately the Masonic ones. My research began to deepen. I spoke with more people. Numinous things happened. It has been rumored that George Washington, a Mason of very high degree, was sent to America but from England to begin Freemasonry here. And note this big honking comet right here. So, and there's his little, you know, his little apron there. So it's very nice. The symbol of the comet appears in many alchemical texts and in Freemasonry as a five-pointed star. It is no coincidence that much of Washington, D.C. is laid out in the shape of a five-pointed star. It is likely that alchemy and Freemasonry were once joined, at least in spirit. At some point, two traditions formed, perhaps as far back as the building of the pyramids or Solomon's Temple, which happens to be another important Masonic symbol. Henry began driving lessons in late August when he was 15. My husband, Mark, who's running our slide projector here, and I took him to classes on Saturdays and Sundays. I sat in the Starbucks across the street and researched comets on my laptop. One day, early in September, I had an interesting conversation with a man sitting across from me. I don't remember how or why it came up, but he said at one point in our conversation, "If anything happened to me, there's a group of people who would take care of me." On a whim, I asked, "Oh, are you Mason?" And he said, "Yes, I am." I kept a cool head and remained as matter-of-fact as I could. He revealed things to me that confirmed what I had only read in books and other research sources. He told me that the Oddfellows and the Masons are like that. Use that gesture. He said they shared common symbolism. The synapses of my brain were now working overtime. I asked him why an Oddfellows lodge would be called Comet when it was not a symbol in their tradition. He told me it was possible the men who named the Oddfellows Comet Lodge had brought the name with them from another Comet Lodge, but I told him I'd exhausted that avenue, or so I believed. He wondered if the Oddfellows who named the Comet Lodge were Masons because, he said, the comet was a symbol in Masonic tradition. He mentioned the Master Mason degree passage I quoted earlier about the all-seeing eye and comets being under the watchful eye of God. My weird and extensive knowledge of these two groups made his tongue loosen even more. He said he was a member of the Greenwood Masonic Lodge. He speculated with me about the lodge ceiling. He said, "Yeah, you know, when the lights are turned out during our meetings, there's a comet painted in the corner of the ceiling in phosphorescent paint. I've always wondered if it was Halley's Comet." I was screaming inside. I was once again in the ecstasy from this conversation. No surprise I never heard from this man either again. In some of my research on the Masons, I learned some startling things. It is rumored that if a Mason talks about Masonic rituals and secrets, he can be killed. Masons are said to take this seriously, and there is some historical evidence that they mean it. The ornaments of the Masonic Lodge include the black and white tessellated mosaic pavement. And here is the five-pointed star in the center, which represents the ground floor of King Solomon's Temple. In the floor is indented the blazing star. In 1730, Samuel Pritchard published a book, Masonry Dissected. He refers to the blazing star as a comet. Another example comes from an early French Masonic text, La Réception Mystérieuse, from 1738, which states, "The pavement of the room is decorated with Masonic work. The comet is in the center, and the room is carpeted all around with a brocade of gold." Faith, my high school friend, told her colleague, a colleague of hers, David, a math teacher at Cleveland, about my research on comets. David had been researching everything from linguistics to conspiracy theories to the Masons. David said the Masons were responsible for the American Revolutionary War and the French Revolution, which I already kind of knew, and even 9/11. Faith told me that he had researched the linguistic origin of the word comet for me. I responded with another gasp. So I met with David. He said the Masons had likely formed many years prior to the 12th century, which is the era to which they admit their origin. According to some beliefs, including David's, the Masons actually built Solomon's Temple. Furthermore, by some accounts, the original Masons were Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, my own heritage, who had gone to the Middle East and perhaps were even responsible for building the pyramids. David's research was actually very well documented. I was enthralled with his breadth of knowledge and this information. David discussed the linguistic research he had done on the word comet. Broadly conceived, linguistics is a study of human language and how it formed from the observations made by early humans of animal sounds and the sounds in nature. Linguistics concerns itself with sounds. Etymology, on the other hand, concerns itself with word usage and word history. Sometimes the two areas of study coincide and sometimes not. So David researched the linguistic origins of the word comet from Harold Bailey's The Lost Language of Symbolism, which was published in 1912. His research was impeccable. According to Bailey, the K sound in comet, K, is often associated with the sound for things having to do with greatness. Think of cataclysm or colossal as examples. The om sound in comet is interchangeable with on. Linguistically, it is associated with the word for one. And the final sound, the T, the T. In the Hebrew language, the letter for T is Tav, like the Tau in Greek, and was the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It looked like this. Voila. The cross symbol the Tav in Katav Ivri, or Hebrew script, looks like a cross. And the cross symbol refers to the kingdom of the Infinite One, or perfection, or simply God. Following along with David, my eyes were as big as saucers. I realized the word comet, when parsed out sound by sound, linguistically means great one God. The etymology of the word comet, the history of the word, took a divergent path. The etymology of the word may come from the observations of the physical properties of a comet, as it seems to follow the stream. The first time the word was traced into usage was in the mid-12th century, from the Latin cometa, from Greek aster cometas, literally long-haired star, from come, hair of the head, and finally to komon, let the hair grow long. It's so called, of course, from the resemblance of the comet's tail to streaming hair. The 12th century was the height of the High Middle Ages, and at that time the population of Europe was on the increase, bringing about great social, economic, and political changes. The High Middle Ages produced many different forms of intellectual, spiritual, and artistic works. Noteworthy here was the beginning of the guild system, which stressed the medieval spirit of economic life and collective entities, disapproval of unregulated competition, and minimization of the motive of individual profit. Freemasonry was set to begin as an organization in this same time period with the Knights Templar and the Crusades. The beginning of the concept of brotherhood through the guild system may be why the Freemasons are said to begin at this time. It was at this same time that the word comet came into modern usage. David, the genius math teacher, recommended a book to me, Ancient Egypt, The Light of the World by Gerald Massey. It traces the Masons to Egypt and perhaps even to prior civilizations such as the Sumerians and Hittites. So what are we to believe? did the Freemasons build Solomon's temple, which all their rituals seem to indicate, or did the Masons form in the 12th century as a result of the guild system and the Crusades, or both? So let's take a break. In February of 2010, Pat Warming, who is another of the analysts in our institute, and I attended one of the first seminars on the newly published Red Book in Portland. And this was led by the editor, Sonu Shandasani. I approached Sonu after the seminar, and I asked him, is there a comet in the Red Book? He said, no. However, I later noticed that in the very first illustration of Liber Novus, in the illuminated letter D, where's my Jeter here? There's a comet. So now let me show you here. This is hard to see. Right here, there's the head of a comet and then the tail. Okay? This is the star Bethlehem. Let me get to this. Yeah. Okay, I found it. So Jung had painted this small blue band here, and in the symbols, with all the symbols of the zodiac, which runs the length of the page above a Swiss town. Under the sign for Pisces, Jung had drawn the bright star of Bethlehem, indicating the Piscean age of Christ. Next to this, under the sign of Aquarius, is a comet, but not nearly as bright as the star of Bethlehem next to it. You almost had to be looking for it, and I was, of course. It's very likely that Jung was thinking of the coming age of Aquarius, moving out of the Piscean age, and what better symbol to illustrate the way that is to come than with a comet. Pat and I then went to Powell's books. At this time, I began the research of the science of comets. Now, you've all heard potentially that a couple of days ago, November 12th, there was the landing of the landing craft Philae on the comet 67PCG, a comet hurtling through space about 317 million miles away. The synchronicity of this event to my lecture did not escape me. So I'm not going to go into this, but you know this happened 2 days ago. So 4 years ago, when Pat and I were in Portland, I thought perhaps in astronomy I might find a link with the meaning ascribed to the comet by the Oddfellows and the Masons. I thought, since I had no luck obtaining the rosters of the members of the Masonic lodges in Georgetown, despite Louise's best connections, I thought there might be information in science that could lead me to the answer. The Cosmic Serpent, A Catastrophic View of Earth History by Victor Klube and Bill Napier, was looking interesting. The cover had a photograph of a comet on the dust jacket. That was good enough for me. The authors of the book are, however, internationally respected astronomers. They propose that the origins and future of the Earth have and will be shaped by catastrophe and disaster. Disaster, incidentally, is evil star disaster. Their claim is that comets, asteroids, and meteoric bombardments once caused devastation on a global scale and brought on massive evolutionary changes, not to mention the demise of the dinosaurs. I found a second book in which the same theory is echoed. Uriel's Machine is written by admitted Freemasons and scientists Christopher Knight and Robert Lomas. It discusses the comet symbol in Freemasonry, but does not discuss the meaning of the symbol. They conjecture that a comet hit the Earth in 7640 BCE, split into seven giant pieces, and caused the Great Flood. Noah's Ark also happens to be a huge symbol in Freemasonry. The authors, who are Freemasons, discuss the apocryphal book of the Bible, Bible book Enoch, in which Enoch is given information about a machine that can predict cosmological comings and goings, much like Stonehenge does, and which would accurately predict the regular appearance of comets. It might not surprise you that there are several Enoch degrees in Freemasonry. Both books propose, and this is where it grabbed my attention, These huge cosmic events gave rise to ancient myths, inspired prophets and philosophers, and affected the creation of astrological sciences and ancient calendars. When I had just about had my fill of the science of comets, I came to a chapter in The Cosmic Serpent entitled Comets and Gods. I gasped again. Hit by the Newman, this chapter discusses how ancient religions and prehistoric humans were unmistakably polytheistic and astronomical in character. This raises questions concerning the basic nature of gods that were worshipped. If comets were included among the principal gods, their erratic motion and changing appearance might well have inspired a ready acceptance of the inconsistent nature of ancient gods. Beginning in Greek and Roman times, philosophers such as Lucretius attempted to remove the supernatural quality of comets and began to explain some of them in materialistic terms, attempting to remove the gods from nature. The heads and tails of comets were depicted in the forms of humans or of animals, such as serpents. The aim of these philosophers seems to have been to prove that comets were created by perfectly natural causes. However, belief in that comets were gods was so entrenched in the psyches of the common people that they were convinced that comets were still gods and that the gods were simply now invisible. Perfect. The rise of materialism in classic times coincided with the passing away of very important prehistoric gods, which had been conceived as comets in the sky. Many of the legends of mythology can thus be interpreted as highly embellished accounts of the evolution of one or perhaps several large comets during the last several thousand years of prehistory. As I read along in The Cosmic Serpent, I came to a section in which the authors discuss Lucretius's rendition of the myth of Phaeton, Apollo's son, who in a moment of adolescent insanity took out his father's sun chariot, which wobbled off course. Then Zeus, with a sudden stroke of his thunderbolt, struck down the aspiring Phaeton, who fell out of the chariot to earth, killing him. But the sun god Apollo intercepted the, quote, everlasting torch of the firmament in its fall, unquote, and brought the chariot back to its regular course in the sky. Lucretius describes the fall of Phaeton as a flaming torch. Only a regularly recurring comet could meet this description. Now, this is Jacob Boehm, who is an alchemist. And this, unfortunately, this didn't come out quite right. This is a sword hitting the earth. And here you have the eye of God. And this is an alchemist now. This sword is described as a comet. It's very weird. Okay. Or very not weird. So it knocked me out of my own orbit when the authors of this book then stated, there are further grounds for supposing that the head of the comet is the Father Almighty and Phaeton a fragment of its tail. In prehistory, comets were thought to be the actual head of God. I realized that the numinous and the comet both have something to do with the nod of God's head. My synapses came together in a sudden burst of the numinous, and I realized that comets were considered gods at one time. I shook my own head when I realized how significant this synchronicity really was. Until that moment, I was not able to comprehend the enormity of this concept. So a couple of years ago, Louise, Henry, and I went up to Buckley near Mount Rainier to the Oddfellows Grand Lodge. We told the Grand Secretary who runs the library that we wanted to find out if any of our relatives, the Maples, had been members of the Comet Lodge that Henry might later join. Ha ha. The Oddfellows Grand Secretary at the San Francisco Grand Lodge told us the answers to our questions would not be secret. Nevertheless, this guy saw right through us from the start, didn't he? He was withholding and nasty, and he gave us nothing, even though he knew the Maples should have shown up in their records. A couple of months later, Louise and I went to the Masonic Grand Lodge in Tacoma to look for Louise's relatives in the Masonic membership books. The librarian there would only let us look at one book at a time. We had to stay with him at his desk. We could not find any Maple family descendants listed as Masons. The librarian also showed us some Oddfellows books, which I found intriguing. Why would they be there? But anyway, there were no maples listed in any of them either. We already knew that Charles Stanley Maple had died at the Masonic home in Des Moines. We also knew that Louise's relatives started the Comet Lodge in Georgetown, and their names were on the Articles of Incorporation. When we told the librarian we knew there was information that was missing from the book, she just sort of shrugged his shoulders. Clearly, he knew much more, but he was not going to tell us and refused to give us any further access to research material. Louise and I were discouraged, probably particularly me, by our experience at the Masonic Grand Lodge. For a while, I did nothing to pursue my quest about the Masons, Oddfellows, and Comets. Then on a day off, I found myself on the Internet. Now, information comes on all the time, and it behooves me to do periodic researches. So I typed comet symbolism into the Google search engine, and up popped the book, Symbols, Encyclopedia of Western Signs and Ideograms, page 274, with the words for my search term highlighted in yellow. Next to the text was the illustration of a three-dimensional five-pointed star. And the book states, this star sign is very rare as a two-dimensional or true graphic sign, so like a, you know, but more common cut in relief, as this one is. It appears on gravestones for birth dates and on officers' and petty officers' uniforms. It is also quite common as a sign for stars in medieval art. You know, and then you may recall the stars around the Black Madonna at Chartres. The signs were used for comet in Europe and in the Middle Ages. And this one is Germany, 1596. So now I discovered the connection between the five-pointed blazing star as an ornament of the Masonic Lodge and a comet. I was thrilled. It answered a ton of questions and posed a ton more for me. Around this time, I was again teaching a seminar on Jungian alchemy for the professional seminars at our institute. I was researching the relationship between planetary metals and the symbolic aspects of physical alchemy and Jung's understanding of the process of individuation, turning base metals into gold, or in psychological terms, the development of the undeveloped self. Jung understood that alchemy represents the same process we humans go through in our development from childhood and our archetypal patterns, our prima materia, to develop our true nature as adults, our golden or pure self. Then I came across another book during one of my internet searches, The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual, by brother Timothy Hogan. Here he is. Holy smokes. This was it, a book written by a Freemason of high degree and honor, outlining in stellar detail the relationship between Freemasons and alchemy. Brother Hogan states that Freemasonry developed out of ancient alchemy. He points out that many of the same symbols and operations of alchemy appear in Masonic initiation rituals. He discusses that Freemasonry is far older than most have postulated, and that the allegory about Solomon's temple was probably an alchemical and Masonic reality. The Freemasons may have formed as early as the construction of Solomon's temple and the pyramids. This helps to explain some of what had been relegated only to Masonic symbolism. His book corroborated everything David, the crazy math teacher, told me. Yes, alchemy is symbolic, as are the rituals of Freemasonry, both having to do with the growth of the individual from raw material into spiritual maturity. Yet here was the first research I had seen on the deep relationship between alchemy and Freemasonry. Coincidentally, or perhaps more accurately, synchronistically, I looked up Brother Hogan on Facebook and discovered that he was coming to the Seattle area to deliver a public lecture on his book 2 weeks from then. Had I not been looking on the Internet at the time, I would have missed this lecture, which was fast approaching by the time I saw the notice on Facebook. I'd come to realize that being a female was no advantage in my Masonic quests. In fact, it's really been no advantage in any of my quests, but nevertheless, I have learned to work around my state in life. In this instance, I conned my dear friend who's here, Lee Roloff, one of the most brilliant and lovely people I've known, into coming with me to meet Brother Hogan. and pump him for information. Okay, so Lee's father was a Mason, and Lee had been in Demolé, the teenage group of young men preparing to become Freemasons. Lee knew the secret Demolé handshake. He would be my male companion, the key into this world of men's sacred mysteries. Lee was happy to help me, and I promised him a nice dinner afterwards. I had to ask myself, why was I picked by the Psyche? Why was this task given to me by my dream Russ, when women are not allowed here in reality? I had to learn the hard way about using men for my quests. Part of me railed against this reality, and part of me still knows there's no other way around it. So I recalled a conversation I had years ago with Russ, several years prior to my plot to pretend I was not a woman and to enlist Lee's help in my comet quest with Brother Hogan. Russ pointed out a passage to me from Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Jung's autobiography, pages 226 and 227. You might look that up. It's interesting. Russ again reminded me of this same passage. Jung is discussing his process of adding on a courtyard to the tower. He talks about the delivery of the stones from a quarry near Bollingen, where the tower is, that were to be used to make this courtyard. The master mason from the quarry was present when the stones were delivered by barge to the shore at Bollingen. The stone to be used for the cornerstone was found to have been cut to the wrong size, and the master mason in charge told the bargeman to remove the stone immediately and the stone would be replaced. Jung said no. He wanted the stone, since it was to be the cornerstone of his work. When Russ first brought this passage to my attention, I had far less experience and information about the Masons than I have now. Jung was describing what the Masons call the rough ashlar. This is symbolic of the rough and rejected stone that needs to be worked upon to become the cornerstone of a building, or an archway of a graystone building, perhaps. Now, this is a Masonic... Where are you, Mark? There we go. This is a Masonic tracing board. So you will often see these in graphic depictions. And if you look here, this is the rough ashlar. It's the unfinished stone. And over here is the perfect ashlar. And, of course, it looks a little bit like what's on a dollar bill. And then up here is the five-pointed star or the comet. And then you have the sun, moon, or the other way around. Okay, so that's the rough ashlar. In Freemasonry, it is a symbol for a spiritually maturing man. The Masonic concept is akin to the concept of the prima materia in alchemy and parallels Jung's idea of the individuation process to become more the person one is meant to become. But the rough ashlar is uniquely a Masonic concept. One works on the rough ashlar to make the perfect ashlar. Only a Mason would understand the concept of keeping the rejected stone and perfecting it. In Masonic tradition, this is a metaphor, as in alchemy, for working on becoming a more perfect Mason, a more perfect man spiritually. Could Jung have been a Mason? I mentioned earlier that Jung wrote in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections about his grandfather being the grandmaster of the entire Alpine Masonic Order. I had come to learn more information about C.G. Jung the Elder and his brother Ernst Jung. The elder C.G. Jung was also an Illuminati. Now, we've all heard about those people, right? This is Jung's grandfather, a highly secret order within the Masons. The elder Jung's brother Ernst was also a Freemason. But there was nothing I'd ever heard that tied C.G. Jung the Younger, our C.G. Jung, to Freemasonry. When Jung was at university in Basel, he joined the same academic fraternal order that Jung's father, Johann Paul Achilles Jung, had joined, the Zofingia Society. This is Jung. I wondered if Paul Jung had been a Mason, as was his father, Carl Gustav the Elder. It would have made sense because of what I now know about the father-to-son rite of passage in fraternal orders. Jung's comments about Freemasonry throughout the collected works, exiguous as they are disparaging. I tucked all these thoughts away, knowing I would eventually get to these topics of research. For the time being, my thoughts were on the upcoming event with Brother Hogan. Before the Friday night lecture by Timothy Hogan, I had been in contact with the Grand Master of the Verity Lodge in Kent about where the public lecture was to be held. The Grand Master told me that Lee and I should arrive about 15 minutes prior to the public lecture and dinner, and Brother Hogan would have time to talk with us. I told the Grand Master that Lee was also interested in this subject, since we were both Jungian analysts and had a deep interest in alchemy. I left out my equally voracious interest in Freemasonry. So we arrived at the Verity Lodge in Kent just after dark. I had my copy of Hogan's book with me. I was really nervous. I could not believe I was about to enter the sanctum sanctorum, the penetralium of mysteries of a Masonic lodge. To our left as we entered the lodge was the kitchen, buzzing with activity. All the women were preparing dinner. I had been told by the Grand Master that there are jokes about the canned string beans at Masonic dinners. So Lee and I were not about to have dinner while we listened to a lecture. We simply wanted information and were not interested so much in the lecture itself. The women preparing dinner. I was acutely aware that I would be asking non-womanly questions. I was not even Eastern Star, the women's auxiliary of the Masons. No, I was a female Jungian analyst with a bunch of guy questions, and I was about to pose to a bunch of Masonic guys. It crossed my mind that this might be another big disappointment, but I had Lee with me this time, my secret weapon. We were told the lecture was in the main lodge room. Lee and I walked down a long hall, and then there it was. The black and white tessellated floor, the blazing star embedded in the center, the candles, all the ornaments of the lodge. There was too much to take in visually and psychically. These were all things I'd only read about and seen photos of in books and other research sources. I could not waste my time. I had a mission. I saw some men in tuxedos with decorative sashes and golden jewels of their particular degrees. I asked for the Grand Mason of the lodge, with whom I'd been communicating by email, letting him know I was bringing my male colleague with me to meet Brother Hogan. When the Grand Master identified himself, I shook his hand. Lee then took over. He shook the man's hands too, but he used the Demolé handshake. Then I spotted Brother Hogan. He was dressed in a black tuxedo and wore many golden high-degree medals, or jewels as they're called, including a Skull and Crossbones Society pendant and a red sash. He was elegant. Lee introduced me to him. He also gave Hogan the Demolé handshake, which again identified Lee as the real deal. Lee said we were Jungian analysts, and Hogan acknowledged not my Facebook messages to him, which was pretty novel. No one had ever done that before. Lee said we were particularly interested in Hogan's work on alchemy and Freemasonry, because Hogan had brought together the ideas that even Jung didn't connect, namely that Freemasonry diverted from alchemy in a particular fashion. Both traditions seem to be talking about the way a man is initiated into manhood through sacred ritual. Lee said that Jung missed a huge piece of sacred tradition by not being a Mason. He mentioned Jung's grandfather's connection to the Swiss Masons. Lee said we doubted Jung's father, Paul, who was a minister, had become a Mason, so Jung may have missed out on the father-to-son connection, and that might have been missing for Jung. Lee told Hogan of our speculation that Jung probably did not see the way the Masons were attempting to incorporate the operations of alchemy into their own initiation rites. Lee asked Hogan to elaborate on this. Lee then mentioned to Hogan that there was an area south of Seattle called Georgetown, that an Oddfellows Lodge was founded there called Comet Lodge. He asked if Hogan happened to know about Oddfellowship and if the comet might have been a symbol in the Oddfellows, as it is in the Masons. Lee said he knew that there were both Oddfellow and Masonic Comet Lodges, both. He said he thought the men who founded the Comet Lodge here in Washington were likely Masons as well, since many men belonged to several fraternal orders at the beginning of the 20th century. Lee asked Hogan what he thought the comet might have meant in Oddfellowship, or perhaps if not that, why an Oddfellows Lodge might be called Comet. Lee was utterly convincing that both he and I shared this interest in Jung and Freemasonry equally. It was really only I, but I owe it to Lee, did a great acting job. And then Hogan just launched into it. Finally, here was someone who was not going to withhold answers to my questions, at least not all of them. Gently and gradually, I took over asking the questions from Lee. Hogan said matter-of-factly, "You know that it would have been nearly impossible that Jung could not have been a Mason." Lee also heard this. I almost fainted, but just kept breathing. Hogan clearly knew a lot about Jung. He addressed Jung's analytic relationship with Hesse, whose books Journey to the East and Siddhartha were in part about Hesse's strong involvement in Freemasonry. Hogan said Hesse was actively writing these two books when he was being analyzed by Jung. Hogan stated that Freemasonry in Europe was a far more secret tradition than in the States, and Jung might not have told anyone if he had been a Mason, even at an earlier time of his life when he was at university. He said definitively that Jung had access to books he could only have had he been a Mason. I still don't know to this day how Hogan knew this wealth of information about Jung. I knew that if it were discovered that Jung had Masonic texts in his private library, since only a Mason could have had these texts, it would have been almost undeniable proof that Jung himself was a Mason. Hogan said there was a clear relationship between Masons and Odd Fellows. They were, as we surmised, Masons light. It was common for many men to belong to both the Masons and Odd Fellows, especially at the beginning of the last century. Although I already knew this, having this come from a Masonic scholar such as Hogan was as definitive an answer as I could hope to have. It also confirmed the information others had given me, including the man at Starbucks. Hogan said that Jacob and Samuel Maple were likely discussing the Comet Lodge name with other men in Shasta years prior, before there were 5 third-degree Masons, Odd Fellows, necessary to incorporate the Shasta Lodge in 1859. So there was discussion. Hogan also corroborated that it was almost impossible that Jacob and Samuel were not Masons as well. He said they and possibly other men in Shasta must have really liked the name Comet Lodge, and the younger children, Charles Sumner and Alvin Bishop, probably carried the name to Georgetown. He then showed me a print out in the hallway. A huge comet blazed from the left of the print. There you go. Pretty cool. You remember that? yet Hogan never divulged what the comet symbolized in Freemasonry. What a bummer. So Hogan then said Jung had access to the Copper Scrolls. Of course I said the Copper Scrolls. Yeah. What the hell are the Copper Scrolls, I thought, but I went right along with him, intently listening and nodding my head and taking everything in. He said only a Mason could have had access to them. It was an astounding 10 minutes. I believe he not only answered the Comet Lodge question, but also sent me right back to the idea that Jung himself could have been a Mason. Lee and I thanked Brother Hogan for taking so much time with us. Lee said he was too tired to stay for dinner and the lecture, which was a complete lie, but neither of us wanted the canned string beans. And we thanked him for his hospitality, and we took our leave. As we got to my car, I kept saying, "Oh, my God, oh, my God," completely blown away. We left immediately for dinner at Anthony's home port on the Des Moines waterfront, close to the Masonic home, much better. We were both astounded at how open he had been with us. I also now told Lee I had a new quest, which was the dream which the dream with Russ might have partially been leading me to all these years. Was Jung, in fact, a Mason? And that might seem odd to you, but sort of odd, but you ask any Jungian scholar about this, and they will assiduously say, no way would Jung have joined the Masons. I think this is an important point. He was not a joiner. So, moving on. When I got home that night, I researched the Comet Scrolls, the Copper Scrolls. They were part of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran. It seems that the Knights Templar, now a branch of the York Rite in Masonry today, were the keepers of Solomon's Temple, were supposed to have found the scrolls just after the destruction of the Second Temple. The scrolls told where the riches of the temple were buried, and it is said that the Knights Templar found the Copper Scrolls and took the riches. They were, after all, the Knights of the Temple. Was Jung a Mason? The previous times when I had those niggling inklings, I kept dismissing them as being absurd, and this was now a most pertinent question. I set about the next morning to write to Ulrich Herny, who is Jung's grandson, and with whom I had a previous contact about another research question. I asked Herny if anyone in his family knew if Jung might have been a Mason. He took the question very seriously. A few weeks later, he wrote back and said he had no information to confirm or deny, but he did give me the name of a cousin on Jung's great-uncle's side of the family. I wrote to this man. Since my German is not fluent, I asked one of my dear colleagues, Eberhard Riedel, who is right here, who is a German speaker, native German speaker, to translate and fill in what I could not understand of the email. In Jung's cousin's return email, he said there was no evidence of which he knew that Jung was a Mason or not. He also mentioned the popularity of fraternal orders at the turn of the last century in Europe, which was what Hogan said too. Many of these groups were social or drinking groups, the fork and knife groups, and, you know, a lot of drinking. Some, like the Masons, were more secretive, and some Masonic lodges engaged more in the spiritual aspects of male initiation. Now, pages 226 and 227 of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections are amazing. Even my lawyer husband here had the same impression. What Jung did with the rejected stone was astounding when viewed through a Masonic lens. Jung states the following: "But when I saw the stone, I said, 'No, that is my stone. I must have it.' For I had seen at once that it suited me perfectly and that I wanted to do something with it. I chiseled the Latin verse into the stone: 'Here stands the mean, uncomely stone. 'Tis very cheap in price. The more it is despised by fools, the more loved by the wise.'" Jung then states, "This verse refers to the alchemist's stone, the lapis, which is despised and rejected. This is the rough ashlar, the rejected stone that Jung carved with the image of Telesphorus, the demigod and son of Asclepius, and bringer of healing. In addition to the image of the Telesphorus, whose name means bringing from a distance and also distant light, he also carved a circle inside the square stone, not only a symbol in alchemy, but also in Freemasonry, representing the self and the eye of God. So my prescription was to find the stone quarry near Bollingen, which provided the stones for Jung's courtyard at the tower. If I could find it, could I find out if the master mason who delivered the wrong stone had been a Freemason too? Or were the men who taught Jung to dress and lay the stones Freemasons? Even more, would the quarry have knowledge if Jung were a Mason? As many of you know, Sanu Shamdasani came to Seattle in June. A private lunch had been arranged by a colleague of mine to meet with Sanu and his wife. I was thrilled to have the opportunity to ask what Sanu knew about Jung and his possible Masonic connections. This is the editor of the Red Book. He said he would send the list of books in Jung's library, because, as Hogan had said, Jung had Masonic texts in his library. When I didn't receive the list, I thought perhaps he'd just forgotten. After that lunch with Sonu, I hit a wall. Depression crept in. I felt I was at the end of this quest. For days, I sat around deflated. Then, on a whim, I thought I would try to get hold of Deirdre Baer, who is the biographer of Jung. She might know something that Sonu did not. I found Deirdre's information and called. A woman's voice said, "Yes." I asked, "Is this Deirdre Baer?" She said, "Yes." I said, "The author?" She then said, "Who is this?" I told her I was a Jungian analyst in Seattle and had some questions I hoped she might be able to answer for me. She was about the loveliest person in the world. She was very interested in this topic, and in fact, she said there were several others who were researching the same question. She asked me to email her and said she would forward my email to a friend of hers in Zurich who might be able to help me. I wrote her back that evening. The very next day, I received an amazing email from Deirdre's friend, Theodor Itten, a Jungian clinician and author in St. Gallen, near Zurich. He is an animated, intelligent, and kind person who took a great interest in my work and in helping me. I sent him articles to help translate. He made a call for me to the Müller quarry, where we both believed the stones came from. You know the Mueller coin? No. Anyway, he found out that the stones were not from that quarry, but from another, the Kuster quarry. So now we had the quarry from which the rough ashlar of Talus Forest stone had come. The owner of the Kuster quarry told Theodore that Daniel Bauman, another of Jung's grandsons, and an architect had taken some people on a tour of that quarry in relation to Jung's tower. Theodore said I ought to write to Bauman, which I did. Theodore also found some articles in German, which he translated and were very helpful. I had to kind of retranslate his translation, but that's okay. These were articles on Freemasonry and Jung, of all things, in German. Theodore roughly translated the following regarding the Monte Verita intellectual community founded in the mid-19-teens in Ascona. At Monte Verita, there were founders and continuous visiting persons. The founders were the Belgian Oedekoven and the pianist Ida Hoffmann. Also in attendance were Laban, Grusser, C.G. Jung, Hermann Hesse, Leon Trotsky, and many more. Among them were initiated and uninitiated Freemasons, as well as men from other lodges. Some of the so-called brothers founded a Masonic lodge in Zurich on the Lindenhof, Lodge number 37, Libertas et Fraternitas, founded in the year 1917. Also at Monte Verita in Locarno was the Masonic Lodge Veritas, Lodge number 59, which takes its name from the Mountain of Truth in Locarno. Theodore further said, I think this refers to Monte Verita and later the Aranos meetings. This is where the Aranos meetings took place. C.G.J., our 1875-born master of psychology, yet if he ever was a member of a Freemason lodge, this does not say. C.G.J. might have been a member of a lodge, yet he, as your hypothesis goes, made good use of what he already knew from his grandfather and his father's engagement in these male tribal groups. The vegetarian alternative community, Monte Verita, was later the seat of the Aranos lectures. The Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO, a Masonic-based secret brotherhood also formed there by a man named Theodore Roos and was attended by the mystic Aleister Crowley. A Freemason's lodge was also founded in Ascona, referred to in the article Theodore translated, called the Veritas Lodge number 59. Jung may likely have attended that lodge as well as either an initiate or a non-initiate. My email to Daniel Bauman was direct. I mentioned Jung's being a member of the academic fraternal order, the Zofingian Society, to which Jung's father also belonged in his university days. There's a picture of Jung looking happy as a clam in his Zofingian regalia, which I included in my email to Bauman. When I sent the email to Daniel, it was the summer holidays. This is just a few months ago. In a day or so, Thomas Fisher of the Jungwerke also wrote on behalf of Bauman and sent the following to me. This is small print. Thank you for getting in touch with your request regarding the question of Jung and his relationship to Freemasonry. I remember your exchange with my predecessor, Ulrich Herny, and as you know, we were unable to corroborate the story any further beyond the fact that Jung's grandfather, Carl Gustav Jung the Elder, was head of the Swiss Freemasons. Thus, it is probable that something has come down to the grandson, Carl Gustav Jung the Younger, but there are simply no traces we could confirm so far. You know I wrote back in a New York Minute. I noted the statement that it was probable that something had come down to the grandson, Carl Gustav Jung the Younger, but there were simply no traces we could confirm or deny so far. This, to me, meant it was probable that Jung had some affiliation with Freemasonry, but they just couldn't prove it with evidence so far. My second email was to try to engage them in this speculation that Jung may have been a Mason and perhaps dialogue with them about this. The email I received back completely shut the door. Thank you for getting in touch about this again. However, you must have misread my latest communication. All information available leads me to the conclusion that it is very unlikely that C.G. Jung the Younger was an informal or formal member of fraternal order. If he was indeed a Freemason, we would probably find some traces in his writings or private papers, which is simply not the case. What I think is very probable is that he was acquainted with people who were members of an order, but again, without being a member himself, as this was the high tide of Freemasonry in Basel at this time. Basel was when Jung was a student at university in 1895, not in 1917. Jung was a Zofingian, yes, a fraternal order. Of course, the Masonic connections were in Ascona and Zurich, not necessarily in Basel, when Jung was a university student in the late 1800s. Rather, all this business in Zurich and Ascona took place in about 1917, during the writing of the Red Book, and when Jung was a middle-aged man. A couple of days ago, I finally received a list of books in Jung's library from Sonu Shamdasani, just in time to report to this lecture. I will have to get help to translate the titles into research if there are any Freemasonic texts, so Eberhard, I may be calling you. So anyway, Thomas Fisher completely contradicted himself. I'm not buying it. I intend to go to Zurich personally, to the ETH, the museum at the university, to examine these files to see if I can spot anything myself that is significant in this quest. Given what Deirdre said, that several others were following the same trail, it seems just unlikely that Jung did not have Masonic connections around 1917 during the writing of the Red Book, whether he was initiated or not. I think what Brother Hogan said clearly, that it would have been impossible for Jung not to have been a Mason. If so, it would corroborate Timothy Hogan's statement that Jung had to have been a Mason to have had Masonic books in his library and access to the Copper Scrolls. So, you've now heard my crazy story, which has come from a dream and all the various places I've been and people I've met along the way. Here my work has come to a screeching halt for now. I have been waiting on these street corners many times in these last years, and yet I feel closer to an answer than I ever have before. But an answer to what? To whether Jung was a Freemason? No. That is not the question or the answer. It would merely be a piece of my life's puzzle. I have no idea what the question or what the answer will be or how I might feel at the end of the quest, if an end there is, right? All I know is that I feel I have been drinking the dream to the dregs. Why do all this? Why is living a life which the psyche demands through dreams and other manifestations of the unconscious something to strive to do? Why is tending to the numinous something that is still valuable for Jungians in a postmodern world? I can only say that not to do so is to fall short of what distinguishes Jungians from all other analytic groups. We pride ourselves in being able to live in ambiguity, to be, as Keats wrote, capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Jungians are supposed to be all right with not having to find answers and follow theories. We are, as a group, required to face up to our shadows and to go on nightsea journeys. If we explain it all away, I just don't think we're doing it right. I took my hints from Jung. My son Henry is nearly 20 and in his sophomore year of college. I have remained faithful to the process that was begun for me with this dream. After many years into my comet search, watching the skies, looking closely at what I see, following inklings, hints, other dreams and synchronicities, and always taking opportunities to talk with people, the numinous has been my comet. The search for the comet has not led to the answer, but in following its wandering path, I have more questions now than ever. Even if Louise and I were to discover through our research that her ancestors and all the men whose names appeared on the Articles of Incorporation for the Comet Lodge number 139, Georgetown, were also Masons, we would still likely not know why they had chosen that particular symbol for their lodge. We still don't know for certain what the comet represents in Masonic tradition. I can only speculate why the comet was important for them, and if they understood the astronomical and prehistoric religious implications, what were they thinking? I can tell you with great certainty that I've achieved no theoretical understanding of the numinous from all this work. I do not expect to have any at the end of my work, if there is an end. There are all sorts of ways Jungians individuate. On a large scale, the willingness to be open to no answer is what Jung knew to be true for himself as he encountered the images of his unconscious. This way is not everyone's way, but it is the way we know Jungian theory. In the foreword to the Red Book, Jung stated that everything he came to understand began with his willingness to face the unknown with no light and no theories. Do take a look at the very first illuminated plate in the Red Book, the one with the big D for dare. Make of that what you will. All analysts have to learn Jungian theory, but analytic training did not train out of me what has always been natural in me. As for me, the way of the numinous is my way. Theoretical understanding for me, at least, does not make for absolute or real understanding, the sort that could strike me to the marrow. Each time I come upon a light that illuminates the darkness, I feel I know myself a little more and simultaneously realize how much just there is to know. My comet search has led me here tonight and to our workshop tomorrow. I don't know exactly what to expect from our work tomorrow, but I know something will happen. I know this is part of my journey to become what I've always been meant to become. And I hope the work we do tomorrow will give you all the same opportunity. I've pursued the images in the dream for these many years, and so I have been led towards creating new relationships and investigating the most improbable things. This quest has given me an appreciation for areas of study to which I had no previous exposure or investment in the least. From these experiences, I will attempt to demonstrate why I believe it is imperative for the numinous, which announced all of Jung's work, from his earliest dreams and inner experiences through the origins and enactment of the Red Book to the entire collected works, not to vanish from this earth, particularly in Jungian psychology. Everyone has the potential to access the numinous source. It is not a matter of slavish devotion to what Jung developed from his own encounter. It is a matter of what one develops from one's own individual, unique encounter with numinous experiences. I have been compelled, like the uncertain trajectory of a comet, to discover what this numinous dream has been leading me towards. I will let you know.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.